Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The Pennsylvania General Assembly just began its two-year legislative session and will continue to deal with a lot of holdover issues from the last session going forward. But budget hearings for various departments and agencies are underway after Governor Tom Wolf's budget proposal earlier this month. But there are a few issues that have made news outside the Capitol building itself. We'll get some insight today from WITF's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer. Katie, always good to have you on the program.
Thanks, Scott.
If you have a question or comments, you'd like to join in the conversation, weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Katie, I want to go to one of those issues that made news this week, actually outside the Capitol Dome. And that was Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman, who spoke to the Pennsylvania Press Club earlier this week. Governor Tom Wolf, every year he's been in office, has talked about raising the minimum wage here in Pennsylvania. It's $7.25 right now. Has not been raised in 10 years, over 10 years. This has always been kind of a non-starter issue for Republicans in Pennsylvania. But Senator Corman kind of opened the door just a sliver at his press club speech earlier this week. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, he certainly did. I, to be honest, like wasn't really expecting the minimum wage conversation to change from what it has been in the past, which is Wolf puts something into his budget proposal and then the Republicans just kind of go, no, and it goes away. But yeah, Corman basically said this is a conversation that maybe we should have. Wolf's proposal was to go up to a $12 an hour minimum wage from our $7.25. And then, like, gradually ratchet that up to $15 an hour, which is, for instance, what New York is doing. Corman said, no, we don't want to do that. But there might be room for a conversation on a lower minimum. And I've spoken with the governor's office. They said, well, we think the 12 to 15 arrangement is the better one. But we are open to discussions on this, obviously, because it's better than nothing in their eyes. And I spoke to some top House Republicans, too, because, you know, that's one of those things. The Senate can't do anything without the House. So you really have to have those guys on board. It's often seen as a more conservative body. But Stan Saylor, who's the appropriations chair for the House and, you know, a relatively high ranking member, did tell me, he's like, we are open to it, too. You know, it's not something that we're going to say no to. We don't want the high one, but it's possible.
Well, for background purposes, and sure, I think most people are aware of the debate, reason Republicans don't support increasing the minimum wage is that they say it will cost jobs.
Yes.
And I saw from the story that you reported earlier this week that Representative Saylor did say that the Republicans were focused on creating more high-paying jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at the same time, when you look at, it's been 10 years, over 10 years that the minimum wage has been increased, and all the states, including West Virginia, around Pennsylvania, have increased their minimum wage, not to 12 or 15
no,
like New York is planning, but 8.25 or 8.75, something like that.
Totally.
So maybe Pennsylvania legislators, the Republicans in particular, are looking at it and say, well, okay, maybe we're not willing to go to 15, but maybe, as you said, they're willing to talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah, and I do think it's interesting because, you know, we have a lot of data on the minimum wage at this point, but people cherry pick studies, frankly.
Oh.
And
maybe more than any other issue I've ever seen.
Well, that's the thing. It's insane to try to have a legitimate conversation about this because, you know, there's so much information on it that you can just pick whatever you think fits your issue. So we see people saying, well, the minimum wage will have no impact on jobs. And then we see people who are very, very, very doom and gloom about it saying the minimum wage is going to get rid of all, you know, starting jobs for high school kids. That's one of Stan Saylor's favorite arguments. He always brings up that he worked himself through college and, you know, he says these are not supposed to be family sustaining jobs. These are supposed to be like starting jobs that you don't stay in forever. And there's a lot that people would say about that, namely that college is more expensive now. But in any case, yeah, I think the bottom line of this is now that we've seen every state around Pennsylvania raise their minimum wage and we haven't seen an enormous outflow, for instance, or rather inflow of new jobs and, you know, people trying to do business in Pennsylvania because we're that outlier in the region, I think maybe people are coming around to it. Again, not to a $15 an hour minimum wage, but you're starting to see people willing to at least, you know, entertain the possibility of an 8 or a 9. I mean, Scott Wagner, who ran for the Republican nomination for governor, he was okay with doing like a $9 an hour minimum wage, something along those lines. So I think you see the reality shifting on that a little bit.
You know, I think it's an interesting point you just made, because you're right that you often hear the arguments, the statistics quoted from the sides that will support, you know, what you support. But the point you just made about we haven't seen this influx of jobs, even though Pennsylvania has the lowest minimum wage, most often the attention has been on jobs that would be eliminated or not created because of this. Pennsylvania's independent fiscal office said that Pennsylvania would lose 33,000 jobs if this were to occur. Republicans said, you know, we're talking about younger people just starting out. Democrats have said, no, that's not the case. You have many people, tens of thousands of people, who that is the only income they have. Is a minimum. Just examples of how you hear it from both sides.
Absolutely.
So I know in the past there has been legislation introduced. Representative Patty Kim, Democrat from here in Dauphin County, has been, this is one of her top issues. Is there anything in legislative form right now?
To be honest, I wasn't paying attention to the legislative stuff up until this week because I was like, it'll be a non-starter again. And so that's
never assume, Katie.
Exactly. That was dismissive of me, and I shouldn't have done that. But legislative form, I'm assuming people have introduced bills. We're going to start watching them if they indeed do start moving. And that's one of the things, too, for people who aren't like familiar with how the legislature operates. You can just assume a bill's been introduced on any given time.
That's why I asked the question.
So, yeah, don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure one has.
But in this session, I don't know.
In this session, yeah. I think if one has not been introduced, I'm sure it will be soon.
Because as I said in the introduction, the legislature, it's a new session, and a lot of bills that didn't make it, and we can maybe even talk about some of those, that didn't make it through in the last session or weren't addressed, could possibly be addressed this time.
And we'll be Groundhog's Day.
Revisited. Well, one in particular I keep thinking about is statute of limitations for those who are accused and charged with, or at least accused, of sexual abuse of children.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one that I thought would be a priority, that would be one of the first bills introduced. And
I think there are negotiations on that because, you know, now we're on a totally different topic. There were negotiations that broke down at the end of the last session, and I think they're trying to come to some consensus before trying anything again on that.
All right. Another story that you covered this week, as I mentioned, the agencies are in budget hearings right now in front of House and Senate committees. One that got a lot of attention, your story got a lot of attention, and it's one of those issues that a lot of Pennsylvanians, and probably even non-Pennsylvanians who travel in Pennsylvania, have an opinion on, and that is the Pennsylvania Turnpike. The Pennsylvania Turnpike, according to Pennsylvania Secretary of Transportation Leslie Richards, is in real trouble.
It's in a lot of debt, you're right that the story, I think, got more attention than I was anticipating because it's a complicated fiscal issue. But then, you know, you remember a lot of people use the turnpike. And you're correct also to say that out-of-state people have noticed this and been dismayed by our high tolls. So I guess just to, like, give a round look at this, Pennsylvania has high tolls on its turnpike. It's higher than New York, New Jersey, Ohio, you know, sort of an outlier. And the reason the tolls are so high, in part, is because the turnpike has to pay annual sums of money to PennDOT, so the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. The reason they have to do that is a 2007 law that said, you know, PennDOT has to contribute this $450 million a year to, the turnpike has to give that amount to PennDOT. And it has turned out to be a really big burden for them. So what they have tried to do, well, they have raised tolls every year since 2009. So that's been a 200% increase in the last decade, which is significant. And they've also gotten into a lot of debt. They've been issuing debt to make these payments every year. And
when you say issuing debt, in other words, borrowing money.
Borrowing money, exactly. Right. And that has given them a giant debt load. So the debt associated with just the payments to PennDOT for the turnpike is around $6 billion, which for, you know, an entity that's not huge, it's not like a state or anything, that's a large sum of money. And so what's happened now is that people have gotten mad about the tolls. The turnpike was sued by these two advocacy groups. One represents drivers, one represents truckers. They're both out of state. And those groups are saying that, you know, the turnpike is violating federal law because they are using toll money for non-turnpike related projects. And I could get into the legalese of it, but basically just know that they're being sued and that the case is, you know, it's not something that's just going to get thrown out. It's, you know, there's real question about whether the turnpike's going to win this lawsuit. And if they lose the lawsuit, if the turnpike loses, then there's a question of whether they're going to have to pay back toll money, because that's what these groups are seeking. They're seeking, you know, the $6 billion in toll money to be refunded. And if that happens, we really don't know what's going to happen. Leslie Richards, who's the secretary of PennDOT and sits on the board of the turnpike, so kind of speaks for both often, she said that if that does come to pass and they lose the lawsuit and they have to pay back $6 billion all at once, it's going to be a catastrophe, is basically what she said. So that's kind of, I think, in broad strokes, the lay of the land on this.
Okay, so give us a sense. You've touched on it, but yeah. A sense of the debt that they have in numbers. How much?
So, again, the debt associated with just these payments to PennDOT is $6 billion. Right. Mm-hmm. They're carrying $11 billion of debt overall.
Okay. And, you know, one of the things we always try to do in this program is provide some historical perspective.
Sure.
This goes back, as you mentioned, in 2007, the deal that was reached. Ed Rendell was governor at the time. For those who don't remember, just needed to be updated. At the time, the governor was talking about possibly privatizing the turnpike, selling the turnpike. You got the sense at the time that this was almost the turnpike agreeing to this deal to contribute money to PennDOT for projects outside the turnpike was a way of saying, hey, don't privatize, don't sell us, you know, we can contribute to it as well. A lot of people looked at it and said that was a bad deal. Governor Wolf, just a few months ago, said he's very concerned about the tolls on the turnpike because it will hurt Pennsylvania business. The other day we were talking about a shortage of truck drivers. Talked to someone from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, said that they are very concerned, their members are very concerned about driving the turnpike.
Yeah, totally.
They have a lot of them that are avoiding the turnpike, which puts tractor trailers on other roads, some of which may not be able to handle those roads, which then ironically could mean they need more maintenance. And where's that money going to come from?
The turnpike.
Right. So, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
We were just having a conversation that beforehand about how this is one of those issues that a lot of people have opinions on.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of compare it to gas prices. You may pay just 5 or 10 cents more a gallon, but everyone, it's a pet peeve of them. Same with tolls on the turnpike. All the time I'm hearing from people who are saying, boy, those tolls in the Pennsylvania Turnpike are out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens next with this? This was a budget hearing.
Right.
And you said that Secretary Richards was pretty blunt in her assessment
of this. Yeah, she was candid about this. And part of, I think, the reason is they are already seeing impacts from this lawsuit and from, you know, the Turnpike's fiscal issues. Because since the lawsuit was filed, the Turnpike hasn't been able to service any debt. And they haven't been able to borrow more money to make their payments. So the Turnpike has now missed 3 payments to PennDOT. And that is significant because that's money PennDOT relies on. And because of this uncertainty, they've halted a lot of projects, PennDOT. So I think the number was somewhere around 40 so far. This is really going to hit the fan when it comes to like the end of the fiscal year. So at the end of June, so July 1st basically, is when the new fiscal year starts. And Leslie Richards, the secretary, did say if that happens, like if it's not resolved by that point, then a lot more cities, for instance, like Harrisburg is going to be affected in terms of their public transportation because they're already operating on a thin line. Like cities are going to be affected. There's a subsidy to Amtrak that that PennDOT provides that's going to be cut in half, she said. So like really significant impacts are going to start being seen. So we will have to keep following the lawsuit, you know, see what's going to happen. But yeah, there's a lot going on with this.
I wonder whether people realize the ripple effects that you just described.
Right.
I mean, this is not just high tolls on the turnpike.
Right.
There's a lot that is at stake at
this. Yeah, I mean, Pennsylvania's transportation funding system is a broad net, basically. There's a lot of interlocking parts, so it's interesting.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamont. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is WITF's Capital Bureau Chief Katie Meyer, talking about some of the things happening in Harrisburg over the last few weeks, last few days. If you'd like to weigh in, you could give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We are on Twitter at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number 1-800-729-7532. And by the way, you can find out about other topics that are coming up on Smart Talk over the next few weeks by going to WITF.org/smarttalk. In fact, tomorrow we'll be talking about our coverage of the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident. We'll be talking about a shortage of police officers in some communities and maybe even state police, which kind of relates to transportation funding. We'll talk about that. And also Pennsylvania founder William Penn. Next week is Charter Day in Pennsylvania. William Penn, maybe not who you thought. That's coming up on Smart Talks over the next week or so. And one of the things that you can do, we just started this. Maybe you've heard this on 1A with Joshua Johnson, but you can share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. But today we are talking about what's going on in Harrisburg. Another big issue, Katie, that has occurred over the last weeks. Well, first of all, let me just go back to a budget hearing, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of these budget hearings. But Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel had his budget hearing this week. And one of the big issues that the Corrections Department has been dealing with over the last weeks and months has to do with mail that has been sent to inmates in county prisons. First of all, provide some background, if you would, of what was decided, what the policy was put in place by the Department of Corrections.
Sure. So we're going to have to go back to September for this. There was, at the end of the summer, this influx that the department reported of synthetic drugs into prisons. So they say guards, prison staffers were getting sick because of incidental contact with these synthetic drugs.
It was actually dozens, according to Secretary Wetzel.
Yeah, it was dozens. So a lot of people, they now said like this was kind of ramping up for a while, but it really, like, this came into the public consciousness all at once at the end of August, early September. And so they decided to take really, you know, sudden, in some cases unprecedented measures to deal with this stuff. So what they did, they made a whole raft of security tightening, you know, decisions. But the big one, well, so first of all, it included, like, for instance, they got new ion scanners and they changed visiting policies and they locked down all the prisons for like almost 2 weeks. And one of the big changes they made, though, was it had to do with mail. They started outsourcing all of their mail processing to this facility in Florida for regular mail. So instead of mailing mail directly to a prison, you now mail it to Florida. And the reason Florida was picked, by the way, it wasn't arbitrary. They said that was the only contractor that could do what they needed in the amount of time that they needed it. So you mail your mail to Florida. Florida searches it and photocopies it and sends it all back to the prisons now. But for legal mail, they had to do something different, because legal mail has special protections under the First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech. And inmates also have those protections under the Constitution. So the legal mail has to be opened in front of the inmate. And then it has to be secure. Nobody can look at it because it's supposed to be confidential. This is, you know, attorney-client privilege. It's mail between an inmate and their attorney, often in important cases to that inmate because they're trying to get out of prison a lot of the time. So the mail has to be opened in front of the inmate. So what the department decided to do was have this system where they open the mail, on camera, the inmate's in the room with them. They open it, and then they photocopy it in front of the inmate. And then they put the original in a secure envelope that is secured by this special tape. And then they would put it into a box that is, they say, secure, and that was managed by a third-party contractor. So then the contractor has custody of the box. And if that sounds very complicated, it is. And it also...
Sounds like a lot of work.
It does sound like a lot of work. They had to buy new copiers for this, and it was like around $20,000 a year. I think they were like leasing them. And so anyway, the ACLU, the Amistad Law Project, Public Information Law Center, a lot of groups, four different groups, took issue with the new legal mail policy because, as I said, there are specific First Amendment protections for attorney-client privilege, confidentiality, that applies to inmates as well because they are people. So what the ACLU and these other groups argued was that there's too much, there's too many chances for staff to look at the mail with this. So they were saying, well, you know, they could read it when they were copying it. They had an inmate testify in court that people were holding up the mail to the light and like for 30 seconds at a time, page by page, just to see if there were drugs in there. And so they were saying there was too many options for staff to look at this. And then they also were arguing this isn't happening that much. You know, there have to be these attorney control numbers on the front of legal mail. And so they really make sure that only attorneys are sending this stuff. And it's difficult for it to get compromised on the front end with the attorney's offices. So anyway, you know, this is a long way of saying they were saying that the legal mail policy is unconstitutional. And so they sued in federal court, the ACLU and these three other groups, and the American Civil Liberties Union, for those who don't know the ACLU. And what the state ended up doing was settling. So we had one day of testimony. I covered that. And then we had 2 days of waiting. And then they announced this agreement. The prison's going to stop photocopying the mail. And we're still waiting for the full terms of the agreement. But that's kind of where we stand.
Okay. So there was a settlement. But you got the sense that the groups that did go to court were not thrilled with... Even the settlement, in that they still felt that this was overreaching. Now, one thing I would also point out, and this brings us back to today, is that, as I mentioned, Secretary Wetzel had his budget hearing, and this was one of the big topics of discussion. Mm. And the secretary said that they're not planning any changes.
Well, so that was for regular mail. For legal mail, they're making the changes. They're getting rid of the copiers.
And by legal mail, you mean, and you've mentioned this,
mail from attorneys,
right?
Yeah. Right. Legal, I think that's kind of a confusing term because it's like legal, illegal.
Right.
But
legal
mail means mail from an attorney or some other mail that should be confidential. I'm kind of using it as shorthand. So that's mail that needs to be opened in front of the inmate. You know, we went through all that. But there's a ton of other mail that comes into prisons, too. And so that's kind of what we're getting into now. Is figuring out, well, a lot of these groups just still don't like the DOC's policy on this. This is all the mail that goes to the contractor in Florida, gets photocopied, gets sent to inmates. And there have been some complaints that I've heard about that the scans are really bad. Like in some cases, somebody will scan a newspaper and it'll get shrunk down to like a tiny little size that you can't read, things like that. So I've been trying to get pictures. But in any case, yeah. So it's difficult to sue about this, though, and they haven't tried suing on the regular mail because it doesn't have that specific First Amendment protection that, like, regular, like, confidential mail does. So the case isn't as strong, frankly. It's harder for them to challenge this. So really, it's just been complaints about, you know, people can't read the stuff that you're sent into prison. Sometimes the scans are low quality. It's like it's running out of ink, that kind of thing. So what is happening now? In the hearing, I mean, Wetzel said we're not going to change the policy, but he did say that they're working on improving the scan quality, and I haven't gotten any more clarification on what exactly that's going to entail, but he said that they would have some sort of an announcement soon.
You know, when a lot of people hear there are budget hearings going on, they think of them of it and picture it as, okay, this has to be boring. This has to be, you're talking numbers, have...
And to be fair, often they are boring.
Right. Well, yeah. But at the same time, for someone in a position like you that is looking for news, usually there's some some news that comes out of these budget hearings, because a lot of times, whether it's the cabinet secretaries, most of the time cabinet secretaries, mm-hmm. but the people in the agencies, you get to hear the priorities and the priorities of the administration, in this case, the Wolf administration. So with the budget hearings, you've talked about a couple of the things this week. Anything else that jumped out at you over the past few days as far as budget hearings that you heard and said, huh, didn't know that, or maybe this is more of a priority than we thought, but anything that really jumped out at you?
I don't want to speak too much on this stuff because it's just not things that I've covered in a lot of depth, but one of the things that our health reporter, Brett Schultes, is working on is work requirements for people who get SNAP benefits and for Medicaid. That's one of the things that Republicans have really tried to do for years and that Wolf, I think, has vetoed twice now, these work requirement things for social programs. So that's something I think that we are seeing. That's something I think you should check out Brett's reporting on. He's, I think, filing a story today about it. And, I think so. That's interesting. We heard from the Independent Fiscal Office about just, you know, the state's fiscal position.
Okay, what is that? Can you give us a little
The IFO, colloquially as they are known, they're sort of an independent officer that takes stock of Pennsylvania's finances frequently. So they do a lot of studies. And what they are saying is, you know, we've had a couple real good years in terms of revenue coming in. And Matt Niddle, who's the director of the IFO, is saying that he is going to be very cautious and say that an economic downturn's probably coming in the next couple of years. And so the state really needs to be putting more into its rainy day fund. You know, they can just pull that out if a disaster happens. There's not very much money in there. And that, you know, we have to be careful about using one-time revenues. So things like, you know, they will pull some money out of some fund, some pot of cash that they've got stocked away somewhere, put it somewhere else. That's not creating new revenue. You're just paying for things. You're just redistributing what you already have. Lawmakers have gotten a lot of flack for doing that in the past. We saw a pretty bad budget impasse in 2017 and a way worse one in 2015, where that was sort of what they were up to. I think we've had these strong years. We've had an easy budget process last year. We might have an easy one again. We'll see come this summer. But the message from the IFO was basically like, you got to be cautious, you guys.
Look down the road a little
bit. Look down the road.
Katie, you know, we solicit phone calls and emails. You're not really in a position to espouse an opinion on these things, but I will just pass along some of the opinions that or statements that we had from some listeners. Brian says, I live in Adams County, just over the Pennsylvania-Maryland line, and work across the state line in Maryland. When it was time to get a job, both of my teens chose the extra drive to work in Maryland because of the minimum wage gap. So that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about Pennsylvania possibly losing people to other states because of the minimum wage. Let's see. What else do we have here from listeners? Bear with me.
Okay. Yeah, Scott's going to click around a little
bit. I am clicking around. You know, there are people who complain when they hear that click. But,
really?
Yeah.
Sorry to you guys.
Blaine says, minimum wage should be tied to the poverty rate. Anyone who works a 40-hour week should not be living in poverty. If we raise the minimum wage, that would reduce the amount of tax dollars we give back through the tax forgiveness and or the earned income tax credit. Let's see. We also have something that is addressing the turnpike situation. Come to me here. See, I'm running a board while I'm also on this computer.
Right.
Tammy in Harrisburg says, she has a family member who works for the turnpike. Why don't they look within for price cuts? Their health care, they have no deductible, no copays, etc. Well, that would be, and I would answer that, in that that is something that is negotiated with the turnpike. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you ask employees or tell employees that, hey, we're going to make some cuts in your health care or change in your health care, that's a big controversy. But looking within is always probably a good place to start when you're looking to cut money. But obviously, that's a big story that we'll have to follow going forward. Katie Meyer, WITF's Capital Bureau Chief. Katie, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen tomorrow on Smart Talk as we launch our month-long coverage of the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident. Also, visit our website to get an outlook of conversations that we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. The situation in Venezuela is chaotic and seems to be getting worse by the day. Collapse of the state-controlled oil industry, hyperinflation, and a shortage of food has led to a nation that could be on the verge of revolution. Anti-American President Nicolas Maduro will not allow food and supplies to enter the country, and millions have fled the nation. To provide insight into the South American nation of Venezuela and the ramifications for the U.S. is our guest today, Dr. Evan Ellis. He's a Latin America research professor at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Dr. Ellis, welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Ellis, here's a broad question. How would you describe the situation in Venezuela right now?
It's frankly dire due to really 20 years of mismanagement, not only by the current Maduro government, but the Chavez government before him, and the imposition of both socialist policies and rampant corruption. The principal producer of value in the country, PDVSA, the oil sector, has broken down. With it, the destruction of the regular economy, and frankly, the country has run out of both food and medicine and other things, which has produced the fleeing of an estimated 3 million people, perhaps 5 million by the end of the year. So, from a humanitarian standpoint, the situation is a real crisis, unprecedented for the hemisphere. Obviously, there's a political crisis that complements that. The attempt by the transitional government of Juan Guaido to convince the military elements of the former government of Nicolas Maduro to abandon power so that the constitutional government can actually take power and begin to resolve it. The challenges of the region.
When you say mismanaged, and we'll talk about some of the things specifically, but when you say that it's been mismanaged by Maduro and also his predecessor, Chavez, by the way, I have to say that I think there were a lot of Americans who thought that it couldn't get any worse for the United States or the people of Venezuela than Chavez, and it actually has gotten worse under Maduro. But in what ways did they mismanage the government?
Sure. It's ironic because when Hugo Chavez was elected back in 1998, came to power in 1999, it was largely because of the perception that with Venezuela's oil, the prior parties, CD and COPE, had not adequately transferred that potential to the prosperity and development of the country. But over 20 years, essentially, there were a series of mismanagement. PDVSA, which is once the best-run oil company in Latin America, state oil company, was largely stripped of its technical people. Much of the money from PDVSA was diverted away from necessary investment in bringing new production online to social causes, and so some of the new oil production in the Orinoco was never brought online. The Chavez policies and later the Maduro policies effectively scared away virtually all of the private investors that you needed from an expertise and capital standpoint to be able to bring production online. The Chavez policies basically destroyed what was left of the private economy. You had price controls that made it almost impossible for the agricultural producers in Venezuela to be able to continue, as well as land invasions. You had highly destructive currency controls, which made it almost impossible for producers, ironically, even the Chinese, to be able to import and produce things in the country, and as well as really hostile policies in an increasing range of sectors. And so over 20 years, the non-oil economy was fundamentally destroyed. And as that downward cycle continued, you had a robbing Peter to pay Paul type of situation, in which the Venezuelans increasingly turned to China and others for debt. which ultimately was used for non-productive purposes and disappeared through corruption. But in addition to the China and Russian debt, you had the attempt to take out an increasing number of bonds, both state bonds and PDVSA bonds. But then as the situation worsened, you had attempts to stretch out payments or not pay creditors, which ultimately led those creditors to stop doing work for PDVSA in the oil sectors, people such as Schlumberger and Halliburton and others. You had an attempt to actually have legal delays as court cases came in against the Venezuelan state for non-payment and previous asset confiscations. And so essentially, as happens with anyone who essentially loses their work and tries to live for a while off of high-interest credit card debt, eventually these things come home to roost. And so Venezuela is now in a situation where its non-oil production has collapsed, so it's almost impossible to live off of the non-oil economy. The oil economy, which brings in foreign exchange, which lets the state to buy things like food and medicine, has almost completely collapsed. The assets of the Venezuelan state are being seized by the creditors, who are, again, now increasingly getting steam in international courts. The suppliers are no longer willing to provide assets for Venezuela. And so, again, at the end of the day, the things that you see, such as the projected 10,000,000% inflation, something that even makes
10,000,000%.
10,000,000% projected for this coming year, yes.
Oh, unbelievable. So the word hyperinflation is a bit of an understatement. See, most of the media coverage that we've seen involves the violence at the border, the food that is not getting in. What's with Maduro and not allowing, I mean, his people are starving, and yet there are, hundreds of thousands of tons of food and supplies that are right at the border, ready to come in, and the Venezuelan military sets fire to some of these tractor trailers. What's with that?
The bottom line, and this is consistent with what Hugo Chavez did before him, is that the desire of this leftist regime to not have to cede power is so great that anything that could threaten that power, including the interests of the Venezuelan people and the grave needs that they have, is put secondary. I think what Maduro understands is that to allow President Guaido to really show his ability to provide the needs of the Venezuelan people, which Maduro himself has neglected, and allow those aid flows in, the fear, of course, is that the situation would get out of control. You have a very discontented grouping of Venezuelan military, both the regular army and the National Guard and others, who are largely holding on because the involvement of their leadership with various criminal activities over the years and their fear of losing power, as well as Cuban intelligence, which helps the Maduro regime keep an eye on them. And so there's a fear that if you begin to allow aid flows in and other actors, that the situation that they're just barely holding on to retain the loyalty of those units could spin out of control. And indeed, I think we've already seen by some one report I saw that as many as 450 Venezuelan military members may have abandoned their posts and gone over to Colombia just in recent days, which is small, but it's still significant. So I think clearly the reluctance of Maduro is he would prefer to let the Venezuelan people starve rather than risk losing control, which could ultimately result in not only the loss of power, but the loss of his ill-gotten gains and those of people such as Diosdado Cabello that support him, and then ultimately, possibly their extradition to the United States and jailing for some of the crimes that they've committed over the years.
Sounds like Kim Jong-un in North Korea to some degree, that there are some parallels there. But you said earlier that unprecedented in this hemisphere. And I have to say that one of the first things I think of when I hear what's going on in Venezuela, I think of Cuba back in the 1950s. Now, there are some big differences, but when we're talking about foreign influence like China, now China, from what I understand, mostly is economic in Venezuela. But Russia is a different story, that there's some Russian influence in Venezuela right now. And again, this is in the same hemisphere as the United States.
Absolutely. It's probably important to emphasize the role that the Cubans play first, but as well as the Russians and the Chinese, each in some way complement each other, but play different roles. And so for me, the contribution of the Cubans, who probably have the best understanding on the ground and ultimately play a bit of a kingmaker role and clearly have received many benefits, including a great deal of Venezuelan oil over the years. But Cuban intelligence is one of the key entities that is helping to prevent the collapse of those military loyalists to Maduro right now. The role of the Russians is probably a lot weaker than the role of the Chinese, and as well as probably weaker than the role of the Cubans in terms of a on-the-ground understanding of what's going on. But in the oil sector, of course, you have the company Rosneft, only one of the five Russian companies which have not basically fled the poor performance in Venezuela. But the head of Rosneft, Igor Sechin, is a close intelligence community ally of Vladimir Putin. And in some ways, it has acted to pursue state interest more than economic interest and continuing to loan money to Maduro. And probably even more important than just the loaning money, Rosneft recently acquired an interest in an Indian refinery, the Vadnyar refinery, which is one important way in which Maduro can escape from some of the sanctions and escape from the blocking of oil into the U.S. Gulf Coast in order to, as a matter of fact, almost 400,000 barrels of Indian oil, of Venezuelan oil, actually goes to India right now, which has the unique capability outside of the United States to refine that oil, again, thanks in part to Rosneft. The weakness of the Russians, though, is that they are vulnerable to, for example, U.S. sanctions. They had some claim on Citgo, but that might not pass a congressional review that we call a CFIUS review for being able to take control of those assets. On the other hand, the Chinese, who, as you know, have loaned over $65 billion over the years to Venezuela in largely non-productive projects, have really tightened up on the money that they've given in recent years. They continue to give a trickle of money and work on the ground in the projects such as Sinovensa to help the Venezuelans pump oil that is basically designed to help repay the money that the Chinese have loaned previously. There's some nominal Chinese diplomatic support, but at the end of the day, it's a matter of really Chinese money and the fact that the PDVSA accounts have largely been transferred into Chinese bank accounts. Some Russian role and really Cuba in the intelligence and security domain that are helping to keep Maduro at least alive on the ground in Venezuela right now.
This is a humanitarian crisis. The people of Venezuela are suffering. I mean, when you're going hungry and you're desperate for food for your family, for your children, for yourself, obviously that is a number one priority for the people of Venezuela. But from a foreign affairs perspective, from a policy perspective of the United States, what are the ramifications of the chaos in Venezuela for the U.S.?
There's really three groups of ramifications. Number one is the question of the stability of the entire region. As I mentioned before, you have the refugee crisis. It's especially for Venezuela's neighbor Colombia. You've had well over a million refugees pouring into Colombia to stay. Well over that, passing through Colombia, going to other places. But the refugee crisis has interacted in very difficult ways with some of the most delicate, unstable areas of Colombia, such as the Catatumbo region just outside of Cúcuta, where, again, you have fights between various different militias, production of cocaine and things like that, as well as, frankly, putting an enormous strain on the Colombian economy. You have also questions of the transformation of Venezuela into a regional hub for organized crime, the presence of groups such as those formerly active in Colombia, remnants of the FARC guerrillas, remnants of the ELN guerrillas. You have prison gangs, which are referred to as the Prenes. I just came back from Guyana recently, where one of the issues in the interior of Guyana is the impact of another group of Venezuelan criminals called the sindicatos, which, again, are involved in taxing and extorting and sometimes robbing activists in the Guyanese mining sector. And so really across the region, whether it's the hiding of terrorist actors or creating spaces in which criminality can thrive or sending out refugees that destabilize the region, number one is that Venezuela has become a source of instability. Number two is the question of the future of democracy. And so you have other authoritarian regimes who have used pseudo-democratic processes to hijack the country for their benefit. Of course, Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo in Nicaragua. You have, of course, as you mentioned, the continuation of the Cuban regime. You have other states such as Bolivia. And the question then becomes that what happens in Venezuela has precedent for the future of democracy and the future of others, even in currently democratic regimes, who would use the discontent of the people to hijack that democracy. And then finally, you have the question of the future of external actors. Now, for me, there's nothing implicitly bad about doing business with a country such as China if it's transparent and legitimate. But the issue of a country such as China, or as you mentioned before, Russia, exploiting little transparent populist regimes such as Venezuela in order to pursue their own strategic position in the region. Really, what happens in Venezuela is in many ways a litmus test for whether China has a constructive engagement in Latin America or whether it can continue to work with countries like Venezuela to really expand its position in a way that threatens that of the United States and democratic actors in the region.
Dr. Ellis, we only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being on the program with us today. Every once in a while, you hear the mention of military action by the Trump administration toward Venezuela, in Venezuela. Is that an option, and what would that military action be? What would it look like?
Well, the administration's clearly said that all options are on the table. I think, in my personal opinion, there is a desire to avoid military action if possible. I really look at the situation almost like a bank robbery gone bad or a hostage situation. Essentially, the criminal regime of Maduro, you know, has the hostages, and so when you have a hostage situation, time is on your side, because you know that those holding the hostages, you control the water, you control the light, you control the electricity, one desires to avoid the loss of life, because military intervention, or at least military action, could lead to chaos with respect to the fracturing of the National Guard, with respect to the colectivos, with respect to the other criminal groups. So I think all actors are proceeding cautiously right now, but again, as happens with a bank robbery, hostage taking situation. At the end of the day, the intention of the police is not to allow the bank robbers to get away with their ill-gotten gains, but rather to wait them out in order to resolve the situation in a way that's consistent with justice, that avoids loss of life, to the extent possible.
And we do have about 2 minutes. I try to give you some updates on that time here. Here's something you don't hear about very much anymore, but historically, I mean, this is something that has been around for 200 years. That is the Monroe Doctrine, which says that the United States will intervene if there is something in this hemisphere where another country. Does that apply at all?
Well, the Monroe Doctrine has often been mischaracterized, not least by the Venezuelans and the Russians and others who support them for their own particular interest. If you recall the Monroe Doctrine, the concept originally was that the United States, which is actually part of this hemisphere, both physically and in other ways, recognized that meddling or intervention by the Europeans potentially against the interest of the hemisphere. And so the idea initially of the Monroe Doctrine is we as part of the hemisphere were using the capabilities that we had to try to defer outside meddling. Now, in the current time, the issue with concern over China or Russia, again, the idea is that we in the United States have a vested interest in this hemisphere. But I believe the position that our administration has adopted also is to emphasize things like democracy and good governance, basically to help the states of the hemisphere to be able to get the best possible deal from legitimate economic interactions with outside actors such as China, while at the same time being on guard against the more nefarious attempts to influence and leverage vulnerabilities and sentiments like leftist populism to be able to do things that would threaten democracy in the hemisphere. So I think the United States is looking for best ways to be a good partner, largely because what happens in this hemisphere, as we've seen by the current refugee crisis, in Venezuela, as well as our own, the crisis at our own border. What happens in the hemisphere in Venezuela and elsewhere deeply affects us.
Mm. Dr. Evan Ellis is Latin America Research Professor at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute in Carlisle. Dr. Ellis, thank you very much for your insight into what's happening in Venezuela.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we start a month-long coverage of the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island, so be sure to tune in.